It's 7 o'clock on a Monday, live from Studio B, The Sony Show with Craig Smith, and I'm Don Andrews, the technical producer. We have a special guest today. No recorded program, and that's a good thing, because if you'd like to join us, we welcome your call. We have a couple of numbers locally in Toronto, 416-495-0777, or toll-free 1-888-899-7745. The topic is radio, anything to do with radio, and we'll be here for the next hour. Now, here's the host of the show, the moderator of the Southern Ontario Western New York Radio Board, Craig Smith.
Welcome to the Sony Show for August the 27th, 2007. The summer is almost over. I can't believe it. Hey, we have a phone call, maybe, perhaps. We have a very special guest. I'm very honored to have radio disc jockey, music director, club disc jockey, voice actor, theater actor, Don Burns.
Oh, there we
welcome.
Go. Testing. Operators are standing by. Call now.
Yes, there you
not
go.
Not available in stores.
Oh, this is going to be a fun hour, I think. Maybe.
I'm loose. I know the phone's rung already. I must owe money to somebody.
That's amazing. That's amazing. We're going to cover a lot of topics, including internet radio and what Don thinks about radio right now. But we're going to go back and, if you would, tell us how you got started, who were your influences in radio, remember that far back.
Yeah. Well, back in the dark ages, when I was just growing up a young pup in Hartford, Connecticut.
I used to listen to radio like, you know, I guess any kids did. Mm-hmm. You know, my first radio was a crystal set. It looked like a rocket ship. I could get two stations on it. And I was a fan mostly of the DJs on WDRC in Hartford, which is where I grew up, and WPOP to a lesser degree. There were two DJs there who influenced me a great deal, Joey Reynolds and Ken Griffin, both of whom I worked with at WDRC in 1967. But it was interesting because I had never really thought about radio any more than just something I listened to. A friend of mine and I hired Sandy Beach once to DJ a record hop at a local park where we hung out. But in between my senior year of high school and my freshman year at university, I found myself with an extra week hanging out doing nothing. And I was driving my dad's car, and I was within shouting distance of WDRC. And I thought, you know what? I listen to the station all the time. I wonder what a radio station looks like. Mm-hmm. So I drove over there, and I walked in the lobby, and there was a window onto the studio where you could stand and watch the DJ on the air, who was Sandy Beach at the time, another major influence in my career and my style, actually. Mm-hmm. And I was standing there watching Sandy, and this guy comes out from the office. He says, "Do you have an appointment?" Oh, actually, he said, "Do you have an appointment?" I said, "No." "Well, then you'll have to leave." Okay, so that was it. I left. A week later, I found myself freshman day, which is orientation day at Brown University, and all of the extracurricular activities were trying to get freshmen involved, and one of them was WBRU. And I thought to myself, well, I'm still curious to see what a radio station looks like. They're not going to throw me out because they want to get me involved. So I walked up one flight of stairs to where the radio station was, and that was it. My plans to be a Perry Mason-type lawyer were out the window. Mm-hmm. I didn't know immediately that that's what I wanted to do, but by the end of my sophomore year, I was not only working professionally in radio, but I was working at two different stations. WICE in Providence was the first to hire me. I had been there for less than a month when I went to WDRC, not to try to get a job, but to try to get their jingle package, which was the old Pam's package with all the singy songs, the fastest thing in the air, you know, for our AM station, which was officially classified by the FCC as interference. Closed circuit campus station, the WBRU AM. And we used to take other stations' jingles and cut the call letters out and make them our own. Mm-hmm. We had also just discovered, interestingly enough, that we weren't at 560 on the dial where we thought we had been. We were actually at 570. I don't know how our engineers made that mistake. Don would never do something like that. So we had gotten WMCA's jingle package from New York, which just went Fabulous 57, and we intercut those with WDRC's Pam's package. But anyway, to get back to DRC, I brought a tape of me, and I thought, well, maybe I can get somebody to listen to it and tell me what they think. And Don Wade was on in there, and he listened to it, and he was very polite and said, oh, that's very good. And I had it under my arm when I went in to see Charlie Parker, who said to me, we had talked about the jingle package. He said, yeah, sure, you can have it. And then he said, by the way, what's that tape? I said, oh, I just brought this tape, hoping that, you know, Don Wade or somebody would listen to it, because I just started in radio. Oh, really? Let me hear it. Listens to, like, 45 seconds of it, and he says, you're good. You want a job? This is my hometown radio station, the one that I listen to, offering me a job. This was also the summer of 1967 when the FCC said that AM and FM could no longer simulcast more than 12 hours a day, so they had to scramble to fill the FM during the day with shifts from 7 to noon and noon to 5. I think that's what it was. And I said, look, it can only be a summer job because I'm going back to school in the fall. Yeah. Mm-hmm. He said, that's enough. That gives me a chance to find somebody to do it permanently. It also gives you a chance to get on the air here. Mm-hmm. Initially, he was going to call me Bradley Field, which is the name of the airport in Hartford. I said, come on, you know, I'm from West Hartford, and there might be two or three people out there who'd be excited to hear Don Burns on the air. So he let me stay on as Don Burns for two big months in 1967. And I didn't want to lose my job in Providence, so I worked in Providence on the weekends. And I also was a program director at WBRU at the time, and we were in the process of converting the station from a MOR station to progressive rock station.
Okay.
And I recorded a show every week. While I was in Providence. So I was on the air in Hartford from Monday to Saturday from noon till 5, or noon till 6 maybe. And then I would drive to Providence on Saturday night and do a show from 10 till 2. On Sunday, I'd record the BRU show, do another show on WICE, and then Sunday night I'd drive back. And I figured, you know, by the end of that summer, if I liked what I was doing, then radio was the career for me.
Mm-hmm. And, Don Burns is our special guest today here in the Sounding Show. Craig Smith is your host. Did you give our number out to somebody before you came in, our private unlisted number?
I was forced to do it. A friend of mine heard that I was going to be on the show and never likes it when I talk about him and he's not there to defend himself. Because he's a very insecure person. And he's a very shy, introverted person. He doesn't like to get out in public. He's worked, I think, at 732 radio stations.
Yeah, you missed it by one.
Course of 733 radio stations.
Does he have a name?
I have about four pages of radio stations that Jack Armstrong's been on.
Oh, that is. I thought his name was your leader.
Something. Like that. there you go.
Hey, Jack.
Hi, Jack.
Listen, Don, you got that story wrong about DRC. I know the first thing Charlie Parker said to you is, how little will you work for? No, that's the first thing he said.
Oh, yeah, I've been in radio for a month. I would have worked for $1.380 an hour. You know what I mean?
That's what you had to pay them. Yeah. All right. And it wasn't Bradley Field. It was Crash and Burn Field. Airport. I know. I fly.
Sometimes you even use a plane when you fly, don't you?
What was your grade average, Don, out of all of that? And what did you major in?
I majored in English and American Literature. I think I had an 80 something average. A B, I don't know, A minus.
All right, that means you're qualified to work in a museum. Have you been able to get any of that kind of work since radio went bye-bye in the car? Because it did that for me. I mean, have you been able to use your degree?
Yeah, I have actually, because as you know, Jack, I do voiceovers for a living, and very often I have to rewrite the commercials because they're written by baboons.
Oh, yeah, idiots, retards.
But they're union baboons.
Yeah.
In the beginning of radio, it was not uncommon, folks, when you would get a live piece of copy that the jocks would have written something obscene on the copy. It would say something like, be careful, written by a retard. And then there'd be an arrow at a place where there was a misspelling and all kinds of other things, besides the coffee stains and the cigarette burn holes and all the other things. And then, of course, the big deal was finding the live copy in the studio so you could read it, because it was never where it was supposed to be.
Well, yeah, of course. Now, let me ask you something, Craig. Can I say dirty words on this show?
Well, we're technically on the internet, so I don't know. It's up to my.
You're the boss. I'm just
the boss. Oh, why not?
It's okay. All right. I have a story about reading that live copy, Jack, on my first day at KB, which was also coincidentally your first day on KB, because we started on the same day. Jeff Kay, the program director, was showing me around the station. And back then, we had engineers who did everything. The announcer stood in the studio and pressed an on-off button for their microphone, and that's all we did. And Sandy Beach was on the air when I was being taken around the station, and we stood in master control and watched him, and he had a live piece of copy. And he's reading along in the copy, and in the engineering booth, you were listening basically off the monitor, which also served as the intercom between the two. You couldn't tell when he was on the air and on the intercom. I didn't know this at the time. And
I don't think I ever knew it. That explains why they were always listening when I was pitching those girls on the phone.
That's exactly. The union allowed them. They encouraged that, actually. So Sandy's reading this piece of copy. I'm standing there watching him in my first big station ever. And he's going, and come on down to Smith's broadcast. Oh, fuck. And continues on without missing a beat. Didn't know that in the middle of it, he turned his mic off just to say that. And that was the beginning of the KB years. And from there, it was pretty much all downhill.
Well, Don, what Don doesn't want to tell you, and he's so modest, is he was our music director and
That's
had
right.
a sense of humor. Mm-hmm. He would do things like, for instance, relabel the women's and men's bathrooms, Elton John and Olivia Newton-John, although looking back on it, Elton John could have gone either way. Yeah. However,
and was at the time, actually.
We didn't know that then. And he called me in the music room one day when I came to work, and he said, I got a great new song for you. I know this is a hit, and I want you to honk this really hard at night. I said, yeah, what is it? And he played Stickball for me. Which is the dirtiest song that has ever been recorded by anybody anywhere at any time. But it starts off like a really serious song, and you're saying to yourself, hey, this is going to be really good. And it was so funny the way he did it, that when our favorite record promoter, Rich Sargent, showed up, we pulled the same trick on him.
I remember actually one of the greatest moments of my professional career was cornering Dick Clark at a convention and saying, Dick, I got this song for you. You got to hear it, and playing it for him. And he was on the floor. He thought it was hysterical as well.
He could really laugh. That guy was as common as a pair of brown shoes. There was no star business, show business about him. He was, and that's the way all of the great ones are, folks. If we don't get anything else imparted tonight, understand that. I knew Hank Fonda. I knew all kinds of people when I was in Hollywood, and they were just like the guy that lives next door. Henry Fonda showed up one night for an Oscar ceremony where he was nominated for something. I can't remember what the hell it was. He drove up in like a 53 Chevy. Everybody else has got a brand new limo and they got their tux off. Henry gets out with a pair of brown shoes on and a brown suit, hands the keys to the kid who's parking the car and said, be careful, I've had this one a long time.
Nice. Yeah,
that's the star right there.
I'll back up. There are some idiots out there, but there's some awfully nice people that you are very approachable, and they're very aware of their public persona, and they're very nice people. I remember in Buffalo once, Elton John was performing when the Persuaders, I think, were opening, the a cappella mm-hmm, group, mm-hmm, the Persuaders, mm-hmm, and their airplane had gotten stuck in New York or something, and they were going to be late. And Elton just decided, okay, I'm going to walk on stage right now. And he goes on stage. He says, look, the Persuaders are late. I don't want you folks to sit here, so you don't mind if I just sit down and play a few songs until they arrive. This is like a star here, you know, doing this. It was very impressive.
Yeah. I've got a little bit of tape here that I want to play for Don and Jack. Jack, you just left WKBW in 1973. So we're going to play this. It's not Uh-oh. Very good. It's not very good because... Again,
because it's Jack. Oh, no.
No, it's because it's Don.
Don't use my name in vain.
No. When Jack, for the background for the listeners, when Jack left, they had a contest. They had a contest for to replace Jack.
Great American talent, huh?
That's right. But for four nights, at least three nights, maybe four, Don had special guests on, like Albert Hammond and...
Peter Yarrow,
yeah. And Tony Orlando. And here's a bit of this.
Uh-oh.
And you ended up hiring who? Never mind. At any rate, look,
hang on.
Stumbling on to people who are really good, especially
for bringing in Tony Orlando tonight. Tony?
I certainly would like to thank everybody here at WKBW for even asking me to come down to do this nonsense. And, I hope I passed the test. It was a very difficult thing to do. I compliment every disc jockey that works here.
I think you did a good. I think that I probably helped you pass the test. I helped you along so much.
You notice I won't. I'm not even going to ask you that, folks. But really, Don's a wonderful man, and he did help me. He gave me a couple of sheets to tell me when to do the weather, and he said pick a song, and that's about it. If I bombed, I take the blame, but if I was successful, I'll take the compliments.
You'll be on the telephone, too.
And I'll be on the telephone tonight. That's important. It really is. And I will stay here all night on the phone.
All right, so they schedule a recon.
I don't have to leave till 11 o'clock tomorrow. I know there's a 19. It's 19 hours, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Again, thank you to all of you who listened and called and asked for the next record. And thank you for making it a hit. Hi, Yellow Ribbon.
Wow.
Good night, everyone.
There you go.
Wow.
When was the last time you heard that?
I don't think I've ever heard that since we actually did the show. That's amazing. And Jack is still talking to himself, by the way. He didn't realize.
Was I talking to myself?
Yeah, well, yeah, because you were telling some story, and Craig was playing Tony Orlando on the air with me at KB.
I'll give you a quickie on Tony Orlando. When he did the first tune, what was it?
Not Three Times, the other one.
Was it Not Three Times?
No, Candida. Yeah.
All right. Well, when he did that song, he not only didn't want to do it, but Jay Siegel, who had been in the Tokens, begged him on his hands and knees, please, Tony, I've got to have a voice for this song. I know it's a hit. Tony listened to the bit. He said, there's nothing there. He said, Tony was a record executive at the time. And he said, please, I've got to have a voice. He said, okay, let's do it now. And they went in the studio, and he didn't even have a lyric sheet. He made Siegel tell him the next line.
Come on.
Of the song, and they recorded that song one sentence at a time.
And in film,
until he got to the end, and Tony Orlando completely forgot about it. And the next thing he knew, it was in the top five. And Siegel's on the phone saying, "Hey, listen, man, we got to get a group together. I mean, it's Tony Orlando and Don, or it's Don at that point. It wasn't even Tony Orlando; it's Don. We got to find two other singers, and on and on and on." And they slapped together that group, and the group, the two girls he got from L.A., didn't want to be in the group. They said, this is a horrible record. He said, I know, but it's a hit. And they just kept having hits. I mean, that whole thing was serendipity. Anyway, back to Aerosmith, when we got ready to do Brown.
We didn't hear the Aerosmith story because that's when the air check was on.
Oh.
So
okay.
Please regale us with your Aerosmith story.
Take two.
All right, let's see. I go to a concert in Buffalo just before I leave. I've given my notice to Jeff, who was very surprised. And they had turned me down for a raise 2 months before. I don't know what they thought I was going to do, just sit still. But at any rate, I went to this concert. The concert was Jackson Browne, JoJo Gunn, and a warm-up group called Aerosmith.
Huh.
And it was a small auditorium downtown whose name escapes me. Any rate, I went in high as the cost of living, which figures for me when I don't have to be on the air. And I'm sitting there buzzed out of my mind. And the opening act, of course, is Aerosmith. Well, I expect absolutely nothing. But they come out and do the album, Side A, cut 1 through 6. And that's it. That's the act. Every single one of the cuts was incredible. I got a standing ovation. I was like, who in the hell are these guys? So I went back to the station and begged you to add the record. You told me, Dream On. Okay, fine. I went back to Pittsburgh, went down to Pittsburgh to work there, and I tried to get them to add the record. Of course, it wasn't top five in New York City, so they wouldn't add it. So what happened was we decided free concerts would be a great way to promote the station. I honked that as hard as I could from the moment I walked in there. Finally, we get a concert together. We got several big concerts together, but the one we got together
music
was Brownsville Station, smoking in the boys' room. Gosh, we were trying to shake that image. We didn't want to be known as Teeny Bopper, because what happened when at that point there was a schism in listening on the radio. FM was listening to AOR, album-oriented music, headbanger music, if you will, acid rock, and we were over here playing Donny Osmond. So, I mean, we're trying to get back more towards mainstream, and here they add Brownsville Station as a headliner. So I said, if you're going to do that, I said, call Krebs in New York. I called Steve Popovich, who was running Epic at the time, and I said, Steve, I've got to have an act. I said, can Aerosmith perform? And they were on Columbia. He was doing really both. He said, wait a minute, let me ask him. So he says, I'm going to call Krebs. Krebs is going to call you. Krebs was their manager. Krebs called me, and he said, will you add the record if we show up? I said, I can't say that. I'm not music director. I said, but if the group is half as dynamic as I saw them on stage in Buffalo, you won't care. I said, the album will go through the wall. So he said, he thought about it for a second. He said, yeah, okay, we'll do it. We helicoptered them into the concert. They had already had their equipment set up. We had like 80,000 people out in the park, which, by the way, was nowhere near the largest crowd I ever performed in front of. The largest crowd I ever performed in front of was also in Pittsburgh, and it was well over 250,000. But at any rate,
And that's even before the internet and porn.
Yeah, that's right. That was even before people took their clothes off on stage. At any rate, what happened was Aerosmith was the first, well, second act. We had a local group first, and then I was to put on Aerosmith, and I went out and said, listen, guys, you've never heard of this group before, but I'm going to tell you right now, before they finish the first record, you're going to be on your feet. By the time they finish the second record, you're going to be screaming and yelling and hollering, and then by the time they finish the third tune, you're going to be rushing the stage. They came on. I put them on. Tyler couldn't have been nicer. I've got a picture of Stevie Tyler kissing my ex-wife's stomach just before she gives birth to my daughter. I mean, that she was there. So, I mean, they went on and just blew everybody away. Everybody. I mean, and that, exactly as I predicted, because WDVE wasn't even playing the album at that point in Pittsburgh, they became an overnight sensation in Pittsburgh. The way they made their reputation was in person, not with records, in person. So it can be done, but, I mean, it's hard work.
Yeah, that's what we're finding up here in Toronto right now, that, you know, with the lack of airplay for new artists, it's basically you have to go out there and tour and tour and tour right now, which is a shame because it sort of should be a partnership, I think, anyway.
Well, the way the music industry is these days, though, it's just it's changed so completely. It's in the process of changing even more. Notice I say process now, Jack. It's in the process of changing even more, and more groups realize that they have to take matters into their own hands. They got to build their own base as best they can, and touring is one of the best ways to do that.
Well, listen, there's a background to this, folks. He's not telling you. What used to happen around here for the last 7 or 8, 9, 10 years was the independents decided what you would buy.
Uh-huh.
The independents simply went to a radio station. Independent promoters went to the radio station. They weren't representing the label. They were representing the group or the song, so that separated them from payola. And they went to the radio stations who would play ball, and I know a lot of these guys. In fact, they're friends, and they said, well, it was 85% of the stations that were playing contemporary music. They went to these stations and said, what will it take to get you to add the record and play it in decent rotation so people can hear it and make it move up the charts? And the guy'd say, well, I need a half an ounce of blow. I need, you know, I need $4,000 or $3,000 in my pocket, and you got to rack the tune for me in town so people can buy it. And they did all of that, and that's how come the music sucks so bad over the past 10 years. It was because of what could be bought.
Interestingly enough, this brings me to a story about the what Tony Orlando was talking about. And I don't even know if you know this, Jack, but the reason that, we would have played it eventually, but the reason that KB was the first station in North America to play Tie a Yellow Ribbon was because of an independent promoter. Now, back in these days, the independent promoters were actually people with integrity, and they did not believe in anything more than taking you out to dinner occasionally. There were no, you know, lining the pockets. We didn't ask for money. I mean, I even remember once getting a $50 bill in a 45 for us to play it, and taking it into Jeff and saying, what should I do with this? And Jeff sent it back to the label with a very strongly worded note that we would never play their product again if they ever tried that. Mm-hmm. You know, there was integrity, but there was an independent promoter who in Buffalo who I respected an awful lot, and I felt knew an awful lot about music. Jerry Myers is his name. Mm-hmm. And he walked in the studio one day while I was doing my show, and he said, I have a record for you. He says, I want you, it doesn't even have a label on it, I just want you to put it on the turntable, I want you to play it once, and if this record isn't a smash hit, I will never ask you to play another record again, which I would have held him to. And I said, you know what, Jerry, I trust you. I put the record on. It was Tie a Yellow Ribbon, and the rest is history. I mean, he never pulled that again with me. That was the only time.
He had some momentum at that point, folks. And there's another thing that happens here with records a lot of people don't understand. There are momentum hits, meaning a group has a monster tune. Well, I have news for you. The follow-up's going to sell a certain amount. I mean, Britney Spears has proven that. I mean, you don't have to be good every time, and they knew that. The hardest part is to be good record after record after record. As John Lennon said, I'm really tired of topping myself, and that's what it was all about. It was like we put out a good album. Well, the next one has to be better.
Mm-hmm.
It was just there was a lot of pressure in that direction. But the truth is, there are, if you look back on the charts, a lot of momentum hits. which is why oldies stations won't play certain records, because they, well, they test them and they don't test well. But the truth is, some of the songs, most of the songs they test that don't test well were momentum hits. They followed up a big hit that was legitimate, but the second record was absolutely nothing. Tony Orlando didn't want to do Tie a Yellow Ribbon either. He told those guys, it was the Tokens folks who were producing him, mm-hmm, two of mm-hmm. the Tokens. He told them, he said, look, this is the smaltziest thing I have ever heard of in my life. They said, trust us. We've been right so far. I think they'd had two hits at that point. We've been right so far. We're right on this. So he said, okay, but I don't get it. Bam, right through the wall. One mm-hmm. of the biggest records of that. I think it was the biggest
record. Yeah, it was the biggest record of 1973. And, of course, it led to two or three other big hits and a TV show for them. So, you know, Tony Orlando got convinced in the right way.
Well, see, the way I did it and the way Don did it in the beginning and the way most of us did it in the beginning was our music was not picked for us. For those who are on the pedestrian level, the music is picked by a computer now, usually a week in advance. Okay, the jock has absolutely no choice over what he's playing. So when he says, call in your request, he's full of it. He can't change one thing on that music log. If he does, before that thing he changed finishes playing, he will be fired.
Even the all-request shows sometimes are like that.
Same thing with the all-request shows. Forget it. Now, look, what I would do at WKYC in 67 was I'd tell the people, look, I can't change my music. It wasn't because of the computer. It was because it's what I wanted to play. I said, but if you will ask for this record, I'll let you make a dedication. Mm-hmm, and they would do it. Mm-hmm. And that was fine, but at least it was above boards.
Yeah, that's a pretty standard thing. You get people always want to be on the air, so you tell them what to ask for, and they'll be more than happy to do it.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, we had to do that to keep some semblance of order, but the truth of the matter is what you hear now on a radio station, why it's boring and predictable, is because they've substituted control for entertainment, folks, and that is a lousy substitute for entertainment. However, the people who make the decisions, the management people who make the decisions, believe control is better.
And that's very interesting to note really quickly here, because I know we have to take a break. Very interesting to note here that the people who are control freaks are usually accountants and lawyers.
Yeah, and then they end up program directors, because it's the same thing. I mean, it's like, all right, fine, let's research that to death.
Yeah.
Or as we used to say in the business, paralyzation by analyzation.
Ooh, that's good.
Usually what would happen.
Yeah, we're going to take a short break right now. We're talking to Don Burns and Jack Armstrong on the Sony Show.
I was just thinking, how come you couldn't find a couple of guys that would actually say something?
Well, I'm just sitting back here and, you know, just having a grand old time here. We're going to take a break, short break right now.
So, Carmen Presley, Corey's Clothiers at 569 Danforth Avenue. You've heard the voice. You've heard the address. Studio B, I want you to listen. The power of radio. I can't go anywhere without people knowing about radio. Let me tell you, when I'm on my holidays, I do call reports in from St. Martin. Every Monday, people are looking for me in the island of St. Martin to find. Nobody knows what I look like, but they all recognize my voice. The other day, I was at a doctor's office. Unfortunately, not a good doctor, but I'm healthy and everything's okay. And a gentleman was standing behind me, and I was talking to another gentleman. He says, "You got to be Saul Corman." I said, "How would you know that, sir?" He said, "Well, you're dressed well. You're wearing a suit, but I recognize the voice. I hear you on, I won't mention the radio station, because I'm on five radio stations. But I really believe in radio. It's built my business. It's built Danforth Avenue. It's built Greektown. It's done everything. The Radio Bureau, I feel, is not doing a good enough job promoting radio. I don't believe in print. I believe in radio. Hey, Corey's at 569 Danforth Avenue.
You're listening to The Sony Show on a Monday night, and this is archived through the week. Once again, your host, the moderator of the Southern Ontario Western New York Radio Board, Craig Smith.
And we're here with Don Burns in studio and Jack Armstrong in South Carolina, I believe. Is it North Carolina or South Carolina?
North Carolina. North Carolina. Right mm-hmm. in the middle of the state is where I am. But I have a beach cottage on the coast at Edenton, which is south of Norfolk.
Well,
which means somewhere along the line you made some money.
Yeah.
I made a little. It wasn't outrageous. It's going to be tight towards the end. But that look. If I lose everything, Don, I was going to do that when I died anyway, wasn't I? I mean, you know, so to me, it's real simple. I'm going to enjoy what time I have left, whatever it is, and it'll either work out or it won't. As Vic said today, he said, I turned my life. All right, fine. I did that a long time ago. If God wants me to make this thing happen, it'll happen, and if he doesn't, it won't. So, I mean, that's just the way you got to play life, I think.
Now, I don't know if Jack can hear this. He probably can't, but for the benefit of the audience out there and for Don here, I'm going to play a short clip of maybe about 20 seconds, 30 seconds of Jack Armstrong on 1050 Chum.
Oh, a legend. Now Jack, he is going to be playing something here, so shh.
Yesterday.
Up to sound number six, almost within the top five. Jay, Frank Wilson, and the Cavaliers, who were almost killed in a car crash when it was popular.
Okay, so that you must have been sick or something during that, Jack, because in a 12-second intro, you can usually get a weather forecast and three jokes in.
Well, I think that the absolute epitome was what you wrote on the card of Papa was. You put that now. The way the carts are labeled that we play the music off of, folks, is they have posts, which is areas where there is a Tiffany or something, and eventually it gets to the vocals. And Papa was a Rolling Stone. Dodd labeled it 12, 23, 35, 48. Give up. And I made it anyway.
Yeah. You could, I swear to God, Jack could do more over an intro than any three people I know. But I would, you don't.
Can we introduce another caller?
Oh, yeah, sure.
I don't know if you know this fellow. Hello, caller.
Hello, everybody.
Who's this?
Doug Thompson in Aurora.
Doug Thompson in Aurora.
Hey, Dougie, how are you, boy?
Hey, Jackson, how you feeling?
With my hands. I'm making it somehow or another. I don't know. I've got a cataract in my left eye, for crying out loud.
And
I'm the best straight man Jack ever had, except for the gorilla.
Jack has a cataract in his left eye and a Rinkin Continental in his right. Thank you very much. I'll be here till Tuesday. Try the veal.
I got a better shape than the Continental. Okay, go ahead.
Actually, I spent a wonderful day with you, Jack. Remember last December?
Yep. I don't know how much of that got aired, Dougie. I wanted to come up there so much and be with you guys, but the management at Chum didn't want to part with a penny.
Well, yeah, it was in that transition stage of being sold. They weren't spending a lot of money.
Well, I can't blame them in a way, but at the same time, they have to see my side of that. And it's a business. I mean, you know, I must have done 10 reunions in my life and all the places I've only worked 25 radio stations. I can do that, but it has to make some sense. Like the transportation needs to get covered. I'm not talking first class. I'll sit out on the wing. I don't care. They put me at Motel 6. I'd like a little spending money while I'm there because I always lose $150 whenever I do a reunion. And as long as it breaks even, that's fine. I'm not looking to get rich. But according to Bob Lane, and Bob's a good boy, he said, there's no money here, Jack. I said, okay.
Everybody literally did do it for free, and it was unfortunate that they couldn't spring a few bucks to bring you up. That would have been just magical.
Well, you know, I really love that town. I got to tell you, Toronto is my favorite town. That and San Francisco, my two favorite towns. In fact, I had a record friend of mine who was running a label. His name was Richard A. Weber, Dick Weber. I worked with him in Cleveland. We were sitting around talking at Pittsburgh one day. He says, Jack, there's Toronto, Seattle, San Francisco, and every other place is Cleveland. So, you know, he was right.
Yeah, well, I know that you certainly were missed up here because a lot of us on my message board, on the Sounding message board, had a list of people that didn't show up, and you were on the top of the list. So we definitely missed you.
Well, I missed going, and I thought about it over the weekend, and it was, you know, oddly enough, one of my favorite places. It's just that I didn't last very long, but that's a long story within itself. I don't want to eat up the whole show. But
We already have that on tape, Jack. No problem.
Okay, so, you know, it's...
Doug, is there anything you don't have on tape already?
They don't know about Indianapolis
from you, Don.
Well, someday.
They don't know about Indianapolis for me. They messed up in Indianapolis and made me a music director, Don, if you can imagine that.
Goodness gracious.
So the first thing I did when I walked in the door was to add Turn the Beat Around by Vicki Sue Robinson, which went to number one. Then I did More, More, More by Andrea True that went to number one. And then I'm with the Motown guy, and he's standing there with a stack of records. He wants me to get high with him. And I said, fine, as long as we do mine and not yours. I said, I'm never going to owe you guys anything. And we're sitting there going through the records one right after after the other. We get down to the bottom, and I put this record on, the last record he had, in fact, and I play a little of it, and it has slow opening and some moaning, and then it suddenly picks up, and then there's this nice backbeat. I looked at him, and I said, that's a hit. He said, that's not a priority. I said, I don't care. That's a hit record. He said, hell, I don't even know who it is. So he's looking down at the record. He says, Thelma Houston. I said, yeah, that's a record, man. Don't leave me this way. Okay, went to number one. Steve Popovich calls me on the phone and says he wants me to play another Rainy Day in New York City by Chicago, which he's trying to break. I said, no, it's a dog. He said, it's not a dog. I said, it is a dog. You're wasting your time. It's not a record. He said, Jack, go home and listen to it a couple of times over the weekend. This is like Friday. I said, fine. I said, he said, I'll call you on Monday before ad day on Tuesday. I said, all right. So I go home, and I'm cleaning the house, and I'm tracking the album. And all of a sudden, last cut on side two, I'm in the other room running a vacuum cleaner. I hear this song. I stop, I go back in, I take a listen to it, let it play, turn back, track it again, take a listen to it, let it play, turn back, track it again. I said, wow, that's really something. About that time, two friends of mine from Pittsburgh show up in Indianapolis. They're going to stay with us. And I took the lady and put her in the music room, and I said, I know, you've been traveling, you're tired. I said, I just want you to listen to this tune. I put the tune on, left the room. I came back, she was crying. I said, that record goes in the studio on Tuesday, and that's If You Leave Me Now, which was the biggest hit Chicago ever had. Now, the funny part about it was Popovich almost jumped through the phone and strangled me because he called me on Monday. He says, are you going to add to Chicago? I said, yeah, but not yours. He said, what do you mean, not mine? I said, I'm going to play If You Leave Me Now. No, no, don't do it. You'll kill the other record. Don't do it. I said, I'm sorry, Steve. That's a record.
And
about 2 weeks after I added it, I was opening the Columbia Mail. There's If You Leave Me Now. Same thing with Wild Cherry. Play that funky music. The lady who came in with the epic stuff, she's sitting there playing all the epic tunes for me. And at the very last, some of them I'm playing, she doesn't even want me to play. The last tune in the Columbia pile, and in those days, folks, that'd be 30-some records. Last tune was Play That Funky Music. She's talking to me, and I said, Julie, quiet. She said, what? I said, that's a hit record. I said, let me hear the bridge. And the bridge turned out to be pretty good. I said, that's a record. That's a record. She said, play that funky music, white boy. I said, I swear that's a record. I'm from the South, honey. That's a tune. And she said, are you going to play it? I said, only if you'll stock it in the record. She said, everybody had a list of the record stores I called. I said, if you'll stock it in all the record stores that I call, I will play it. We played it with number one in it was overnight almost. It went boom, right to number one.
And do you recall, having worked in Pittsburgh, you should know the answer to this. Do you recall who Wild Cherry actually was? They had another hit several years earlier under another name.
The Jaggers.
That's right.
That's right.
Very good.
The only was without Donny Iris. It was with Parisi or
Any
rate, it was a great. By the way, this shows you folks how the record companies work. They immediately buried the second record. They did absolutely nothing to make the second record happen. It wasn't that bad either. It's just they weren't a priority, and they wanted to prove a point, and they buried the second record.
Now, I got to tell you that what you were talking about the record companies and their priorities is what I went through for 3 years on CFNY as music director. Mm-hmm. I mean, every time we would choose a song to play, because that's what CFNY was all about, was finding music that we thought was right for our audience, not necessarily finding music that was going to be released as a single. And also getting the imports over and playing them months before they were released here.
That's right.
And record companies in Canada were always upset with us because, oh, well, that doesn't fit our schedule of when it's going to be released. You're going to ruin the momentum of the record. You know, how do you, number one, how do you ruin the momentum of an indie import that only has 300 copies in the city when you're playing it? All you're doing is building up interest for when it is released, and it's going to sell anyway.
But anyway, it's the wrong question to ask. What they should be saying to you is that you're a music expert. You hear that instead of what we got out?
Yeah.
Okay, fine, we'll go with that. Instead, they say, oh, the guys in New York know what they're doing. Huh! We call them iron ears, folks. I mean, they wouldn't hear a hit if it ran them over in the street. At any rate, same thing happened with the Spinners. I'm on the phone with an independent, Tony Muscala, out of L.A., I'm talking to Tony. I've known him pretty well. And while I'm talking to him, I'm also talking to the Atlantic guy who's trying to get me to play Love or Leave by the Spinners, which was the single at the time. And I say, I'm not going to play it. And he says, why? I say, because it's not a hit. I'm sorry. I don't hear it. It's a mid-chart at best. It's not a hit. So, Tony, I go down side A, flipped it over side B. I get all the way to the last cut on side B on that album. And I hear dump, 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 dump. And I say to Tony, I say, hold it, Tony. The guy from Atlantic said, what are you doing? I said, quiet. And I listened to the first 20 seconds of that song, and I said, that's a hit. He said, what is it? And his head is literally going around in a circle trying to read the title of the song off the LP while I'm playing it. And it's Rubber Band Man, which is one of their biggest hits. The same thing. I said, if you'll make that your next single, I'll go on it cold, stock the record stores. He did, went to number one. I mean, as long as they let me, the ears work like a charm. It's just they got to a point where they didn't want that to happen. They brought in Kent Burkhart. He's a consultant, folks. And he said, the man is going on payola records. He's playing records early that aren't proven. Of course I am, because that's what the public wants to hear. Yeah, well, crying out loud.
Too many record executives through the years never listen to music directors. It's really too sad because music directors, I mean, they know it and they're very tuned into their own audiences. And Doug Thompson wants to say something. Are we drowning him out?
No, not at all. I'm just enjoying this conversation.
I just saw your name written on a
piece of
paper.
Well, I just didn't want us to forget that we got Doug on the line with us, you see.
I did have one question for Jack, and it may have been covered because I came in late, but any status on publishing of your book, Jack?
I'm in the third rewrite, Dougie, and we're 580 pages, so
I'm not sure
where we're going with this. I've got to find a reputable publisher. You know, I don't want to work it the normal way, which is the agent, the editor, to the publisher, because what happens is everybody takes a piece of the action. Usually there's even front money from me, and we have no guarantee anything's going to happen. I'd rather get a publisher who thinks, you know, I think there's something here, use their editor, their agents, and put it together that way so we can make it happen. It's a good book. The people I got to read it think think it's very good. I'm a pretty good writer because I write like I talk, which is incessantly.
Fast.
However, it does come across really well. By the way, folks, when and if it ever shows up in the store, the book will be called Rock Jock, J-O-X.
Rock Jock. Jack, am I mentioned in that book?
Yes, you are, Mr. Burns.
Okay, then I'll help you out.
Yes, and now the front cover will have Rock Jocks in red letters on a white background, and there'll be flames coming off the top of the red letters and smoke going off the side of the book.
Because Jack is a flamer. That's it. It's out. It is out, folks. It's right there.
Boy, there's something I've never heard said about Jack. Now, I did read a couple of chapters that Jack showed me and allowed me to read, and they were great. And in another book that came out last year, or maybe earlier this year, The Beatles in Cleveland, Jack has quoted extensively.
Yeah, that was a good book. Swenson, I guess his name is, David Swenson. It starts off kind of deep, but he pans out into what exactly happened, and Norman Wayne and I kind of dovetail on what went down, except Norman doesn't give me any credit for talking him into bringing the Beatles to town, but that was really what happened. That's a good book. It's not very big, and it is somewhat expensive, but it does read well. It does read very well, and if you want to know something about the Beatles, that'll show you backstage, because it's all there. There are some good books like that around, but I'm going to do this one for two reasons. I told Dougie this. I said, I'm doing this for the family. And that version has all of the names, and they're all spelled right, and all of the dates. And the version I put out to the public, I'll probably have to tone down a bit or I'd get sued. Because there were some idiots in my career, and I do call them that. People who were liars, thieves, cheats, manipulators, duplicitous, Machiavellian.
But enough about the sales managers of all the radio stations you work for. Come on, Jack.
But, this business we're in, folks, I mean, I know a lot of you think, well, they just go in and play their favorite records. It is so much more than that. I can't begin to tell you. It is as multifaceted as a diamond, and you better be good on all the corners. So it's been more than difficult, and it's spelled out in that book. And there's so many interesting exchanges. One other tune, and I won't bring any more tunes into this, but one other tune that I broke was, again, the Motown guy. We're in the back production room, again, getting zonked. And he's got a stack of records. I'm going down a stack of records. Marvin Gaye hadn't had a hit in 3.5 years at that point. And I come to this tune at the end of the stack, and I put it on, and I say, wow. Now, I'm working a major disco in that town at the time, too. I said, boy, that is really good. He said, well, it's Marvin. We kind of give up on Marvin. He said, I just don't think anything's, you know, it's not sexual healing, and it's not all that other stuff. And I said, no, it isn't. I said, but it's really good. And so we went on ahead, and I said, look, get me a 12-inch on this, and I'll play it at the disco, and we'll see what happens from that. And so he said, okay. And the next thing I knew, like 2 days later, there was a 12-inch. So I took it to the disco and started playing it. And as usual with the disco, well, the first time you play something new like that, it empties the dance floor.
That's right.
But if you keep it up, you'll find out whether there's anything there or not. Well, by the time I'd played it the fifth or sixth time, I knew it was a record. And I added it, and it went number one. It was called Got to Give It Up, Part One, Marvin Gaye. And it was his last number one record before he got killed.
Now, there's two morals to the stories that you've been hearing from Jack Armstrong, folks. If you're a record person and you want to get your record played, there's only two ways to get Jack to play your record. Number one, have a moaning female in it. Or number two, make sure it's at the bottom of the stack of records you bring.
Like nobody gives a hoot about. Well, see, I would listen to all the priority stuff, and I knew, look, the first thing you learn if you want to be a good music director is where's the fix? Who's getting paid off? All right, as soon as I figured out where the fix was, those are the records I stayed away from. I'm not really interested in what the record company thinks is a hit. Like I say, my experience with them is they're, look, if you don't believe this, go take a look at the number of B-sides that ended up million sellers. It's at least half of the top 40 hits in the past were B-sides. That shows you what the record executives know. So what you've got to do is use your own ears, what the audience is using as a yardstick, and from that figure out what needs to be played. Then you get into the tricky part. In what order do we play it in? And how many slows and how many fast?
Oh, yeah, and don't play the two females back-to-back. This
is
circa 1970.
Yeah, don't play five black records in a row, and don't play four mediums. It's endless, folks. It's endless.
I mean, now, I do want you to know, Jack, that you're not the only one who made hit records by being the first to play them. Back when you were in Nissox, back in the late 60s, I was the first music director to play. I don't know if you remember the song called Wind by Make Believe.
Make Believe. Yeah. That was a Tony Orlando
That's
song
right.
as well.
That's right. I broke wind.
I knew that was coming.
You can see it in my eyes.
I had knowledge of that, Don. I had to be in the studio with you every once in a while.
No, we did crossovers. Oh, no, we didn't. Beach was on before you.
No, we didn't do that many. I did some of the better crossovers I did were at KFRC in San Francisco. They were required there. If you were going to change shifts with a guy, and here's a station that was almost Drake, was right at it. It was tight as a box. And the idea behind it was, you know, you just talk here, you just talk here. Here you read the card. Here you don't talk. Here, and we were required to do changeovers. And some of those I've got on film, and they're funny as all get out because it was one of the few times we could actually say what we were thinking. And some of that stuff is priceless. But changeovers, folks, he didn't explain this. The changeover is when another jock who's about to come on goes on the show of the jock who is about to go off. And the two of them together do the jock that's about to go off's last break. And that is usually spontaneous, not rehearsed, usually right off the top of their heads, and you get a true exchange. Now, the way you can tell the true pros is they don't talk over each other, and everything that they say leads up to something that's hilarious. That's a real good changeover. I hear changeovers today. Every once in a while, I'll hear one, and they're all talking at the same time.
That's because some of the best changeovers I ever heard were you and Sandy Beach.
Well, the two of us, you know, it was not rehearsed. I'd say, Sandy, where are we going with this? He'd say, wing it. I'd say, all right, fine with me. So, I mean, you know, look, if you can't do that, you shouldn't be in the control room. There's another thing about being in the control room that a lot of people don't understand. You'll hear a lot of management people, program directors and managers, and for that matter, people on the board of directors say, disc jockeys are all egomaniacs. If you don't have an ego, stay out of the control room. That's the last place in the world you want to go if you don't have an ego, because it will shine. Everybody will say, what is that mousy person doing on the radio?
You may not know this, Jack, but I remember Jeff Kay telling me once, you and Jeff had a bit of a falling out over something. And, of course, Jeff was the program director and expected to be followed, his advice expected to be followed. And you were giving him a lot of crap about something one day, and he told me he had to physically threaten you to get you to do what he wanted you to do.
Well, actually, what he said was that if you don't do it, I will break your arm. Yeah. I mean, as I recall, that's what he said. And I said, no, you won't. I'll break your face. But, I mean, you know, because I was a lot bigger than Jeff was. At any rate, be that as it may, Jeff had another way of handling me that was very interesting. He's the only program director, one of the best program directors I ever worked for, but the only program director I knew who would do it by inference. I met him in the hall one night. I was usually coming in as he was going out. I was on at 7, and Beach was on till 7. I would come in at 6 or 6:15, and Jeff would be wrapping up and get ready to go out the door. He stopped me in the hall one night, and he said, "How are you feeling?" And I said, "I don't know. I've had a little cold. I'm trying to beat it." I said, "Buffalo weather's just beating my butt." And he looked at me, and he said, "I thought so. You sounded like you were off your feed." So when he said that and then turned around and went out the door, and I sat there for a second and said, "What the hell does he mean by that?" And I went in and burned the place down that night. Okay, he challenged me, folks, yep, in an indirect way.
That's one of the reasons Jeff was such a great program director, because he knew how to work with people and he tailored how he worked with every single person. He knew, having been a disc jockey himself, he knew that air personalities all have massive egos, and each one takes a different, you know, we all express it in different ways, and he knew how to handle each one of us individually.
And
one of the reasons he's brilliant.
If you want to see the creativity, doggone it, you got to let the ego come out.
That's right.
If you want to see it, let it come. If you don't think Jay Leno doesn't think he's good, you're nuts.
And
same thing with David Letterman. The same thing with any of the people on the comedy channel. They all think they're good. That's why they are good.
And that's the reason. This is the reason, exact reason, that radio sucks today, is because nobody can let their creativity flag fly, because everybody's afraid that some client who's spending $4,000 a year on the station is going to be offended and pull his dollars.
Well, the difference between them and me, Don, is that this, if I were running the radio station on my clock, the clock is the place where you do things within the hour, folks, where you read a card, where you say something about this, or where you don't talk, or whatever the story is. On the clock, on my clock, there would be at least two what I would call forced personality sets. I expect you to create in this set. I don't care how you do it. I don't care what you do. Time limit is 30 seconds, but do something. All right? And if you do that, eventually people who can ad-lib and the people who can create start to shine. Then you can open them up and say, "I just threw your clock away. Do what you think is right."
Yep.
Yeah, that's right. And it's very hard for that to happen today with music voice tracking. You really, really can't do that.
Although there's somebody on the phone who did the most amazing job of voice tracking I have ever heard.
Thank you, Don. I appreciate that.
That's astounding.
We're talking to Don Burns in the studio. We're talking to Jack Armstrong from his home in North Carolina. And I think Doug Thompson is still on the line as well.
Did you fall asleep?
You didn't fall asleep yet, Doug? Oh, good.
Yeah. I really enjoyed the voice tracking on WKBW with Jack, and we actually have a heritage disc jockey in Toronto right now that does a show from Washington called Scott Carpenter, and he does a Saturday night program that he does, and he sounds exactly the same as he did 30 years ago, right, Doug?
Absolutely, yep. And he's got really, really, very, very ancient equipment.
Well,
that's a rather rude thing to say about someone, Doug.
whatever blows your skirt up, or as we say down here, whatever tickles your pickle. At any rate, the tracking, folks, for those who don't understand, is when you go in and you're working with a computer now. All the music's on a hard drive. There aren't any turntables in the studio anymore. And for that matter, there aren't any tape machines. It's all on the hard drive. So you go in, and in a production room, you're allowed to get ahead of what's actually on the air and add your voice track to the next show. Now, what you're listening to on radio, at least on a contemporary radio basis, and even some urban stations and on, is all voice tracked, everything but the morning show. Now, in order to do voice tracking, something happens that doesn't happen on the air. First of all, you're not given any time to prepare your set. You do what you're going to do between record A and record B. Well, that's over. Now you're working between record C and record D. Well, that was 20 seconds. Wait a minute. Usually we had a 2.5-minute record in there or 4-minute record in there where I could think up something. No, that's over. Now let's go right now. Mm-hmm. So what you end up with is boring and predictable because these people cannot ad-lib that quickly. So in order to be creative, in order to make the individual inserts where the guy talks creative, you have to be absolutely fertile in your mind so that you can come out with this stuff endlessly, because you're not given any time to prepare it. There's no time there at all.
So what was your secret then?
The secret for me was organization. I organized. I had the weather done. I had all of my trivia stuff done. I had all of the background on the music I wanted to talk about done. I had the usual things, the usual bits that had run across my mind, the jokes and this, that, and the other. I had a whole litany of that stuff. In fact, it took 3 hours to prepare to record the hour and 20 minutes that took up 5 hours on KB.
Yeah, I got to tell you one quick thing. There is a jock here in town who shall remain nameless, who actually takes pride in saying he does his six-hour voice track in 15 minutes, and it sounds like it.
Well, I got news for you. For what Chum's paying the people to track, that's about what you ought to put in.
And we got news for you. We're going to have to cut you off because we're just about at the end of our time. Thank you, gentlemen.
Can we do one quick thing? One quick thing before we before Jack leaves. Can I talk to the gorilla for a second?
Yeah, right here. Go ahead.
Oh, you're sounding old. You're sounding old, gorilla. I just want to know. I want to know one quick thing.
Yeah, that's what it was.
Hey, I mean, you know, you got to say something. You want to keep him away.
Can I just ask you one quick question, Gorilla? Why have you stayed with Jack all these years?
Why is he always where Jack is?
Well, yeah. All right, never mind. Forget the question.
I know the women are going to say no to him, but that means they'll say yes to me. I'm the world's greatest kisser.
Why is it after all these years the Gorilla sounds more like Blind Melon Chitlin than
Because the gorilla retired 4 years ago, and he hasn't had much work since. You know, I never used the gorilla when I was tracking KB. Not once.
Yeah, that's amazing. We've got to wrap it up. Thank you so very much,
Thank
Jack.
You. Thanks, well, Jack. I would have been boring by myself. I appreciate it.
Jack's got a MySpace page, which is myspace.com, Jack ADJ. Is that correct?
A 61-year-old rock jock, eh, Jack?
Well, that's me. Be 62 in December.
Oh, thank God somebody in this room is older than me.
Okay, we've got to wrap it up, folks. Thanks to Doug Thompson, Jack Armstrong, and Don Burns in the studio. And our technical producer is Don Andrews.
Hey, Don.
Well, we got a minute to go yet. I was just going to thank you. One at a time, I wanted to, you know, get rid of everybody and find out what Don's up to next.
Acting.
Good stuff.
I've been doing a little bit of acting. I do improv with the Bad Dog Theater in Toronto occasionally. And I've been auditioning for parts, and who knows what will happen. So there. And, my commercial. Be listening for my famous voice on television or radio near you.
Craig, what's coming up next week?
Next week is Labor Day weekend. We're probably going to try and get a couple of people on about the school system and the broadcasting schools and see where that is.
Interesting. We'll get these two guests back again. They'll have a few things to say about that.
I'm sure.
Hey, thank you very much. Thanks for inviting me.
Thank you, Don.
A lot of fun.
Thank you. And we'll see you next week. Thanks for listening, folks.